That was quick. Is this the special recorder?
I'm Alex, and I'm an alcoholic.
My sobriety date is April 21st, 1993. That wasn't my first time to AA, but I'll get to that. I'd like to thank Sam for asking me to come up here to speak and for y'all having me. It's absolutely an honor and a pleasure to do anything in AA, and I hear a lot of people say that, and it might sound redundant, but it really, I feel that inside. Just to be able to do something for AA is an absolute pleasure. There's a piece of our literature that talks about, says something like, when it comes our turn to share at an AA meeting, we try to carry AA's message. And I hope to do that. There's probably a lot of things I could say that have nothing to do with AA's message and my experience with that. And I'll try to keep that to a minimum. Get off on a tangent every now and then. I grew up mostly in Richmond. That was in 73. I have two parents that have been married. I've lost count, 47 years, something like that. Now they live over in Buena Vista. And I've got one sister that's 3 years younger than I am. And there was always alcohol around in the form of a liquor cabinet or a wine bottle in the refrigerator. But I had no example of how to be an alcoholic growing up. Never saw any of them drunk. I would see my sister drunk later when we did a little partying together. But she's not an alcoholic. And, you know, my parents, made a great effort at trying to raise a son, you know, but they had me to deal with. I wanted to say they did the best they could, but they did great. I just didn't take to them, you know, at all. And I have a wonderful relationship with them today as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, both my parents and my sister. I got to messing around with drinking, I guess, in middle school. And that was the, you know, kind of get a beer at the beach deal where everybody was on the picnic table cracking crabs and doing that kind of thing. And, you know, probably not even a whole beer. I can remember getting drunk for the first time. I think it was in middle school. I honestly don't remember. It was either very beginning of high school or middle school. And that was quite an experience, although I didn't feel like life had started or anything like that the first time I got drunk. What happened was I was friends with two brothers up the street, and it was a single mom, and she worked. We had run of the house, and we'd sit around and listen to Pink Floyd albums and stuff like that, and whatever else was coming out back at that time. And we got into Suburban that was underneath the kitchen sink. I don't even remember what we mixed it with. But what I do remember, you know, just being stupid kids and being loud. And one of the brothers we caught pouring his out because he didn't like the taste of it, you know. And the other brother, Perry, and I were just, you know, beside ourselves that it was such a waste that he would pour that down the drain. And a lot of my drinking would be that way. I got into high school, and I didn't do anything when I first got to high school. I went in ninth grade. I didn't participate in athletics. I didn't belong to any clubs. I didn't do squat. I don't remember the feeling of I'm different than everybody else. I don't remember particularly feeling like a failure. I was just more like a fly on the wall or a, you know, wallflower or whatever kind of thing. But by 10th grade, I had been dragged out of biology class and insisted that I join the cross-country team by the coach. I'd been doing some running on my own. And something fairly significant happened with that. A couple things, actually. But where I had sort of stuck around with the neighborhood kids and we did neighborhood things and dabbled in this or dabbled in that, I now had an instantaneous group of friends that had a much wider reach into other areas of the county, into other activities, into all kinds of stuff, including drinking. And back then, the drinking age was 18, so there was plenty of people in high school that could legally buy alcohol, and plenty of people did. You know, you could still smoke at high school, that kind of thing, and we would just have a party at somebody's house every weekend. You know, we'd have a race on Saturday morning, and then we'd get drunk Saturday night. And that was pretty much how it went through high school. I didn't pay any big-time consequences. I didn't, you know, I know I drove drunk, but I didn't get any accidents or anything like that in high school. It's what everybody was doing. Wasn't a big deal. And the very important part of my experience was when I finished high school, and I tell you this, I don't want to say I had no ambition, but I had no plan. It wasn't like I want to be, a lawyer, or I want to be a master craftsman, or I want to be anything. It's just like, what's next? You know, my dad was like, college is next. And I said, all right, we'll try that. You know, so I applied to some places, and I kind of screwed my grades up my junior year. One of them let me in anyway. So I went off to college, and it was the difference between night and day, absolutely between night and day. You know, my parents were pretty good. It was kind of funny that Alex had gotten drunk Saturday night. It was kind of funny that he didn't get up until 1 o'clock in the afternoon sometimes. It was kind of funny he got sick on the back porch. You know, it wasn't happening every single week, but at least they pretended it was funny. You know, but when I got to college, it was just absolutely wide open. I had experienced nothing like it. Nobody watching over my shoulder. We could do whatever we wanted. Most of the people there could legally drink everywhere. You know, take out in a bar, it didn't matter. And we did. And I got a little money to run for school. And that kept me in check, I think, for a little while. For a couple of years, actually, because I had to be at practice and races, and we had twice a day practice and stuff, so I didn't have time to drink during the week. I mean, we were on the go all the time. I barely had time to eat between classes and running and all this other stuff. But we would get to Saturday night, it was like we picked whoever would drive the van back from wherever we were, whether it was Pennsylvania or South Carolina or Florida or wherever, to drive. Who would drive the fastest? Who would take the most risk to get us back so we could drink that Saturday night before everybody had, you know, everything had shut down? And, I started experiencing things from my drinking in college, blackouts. I don't remember if I'd had them before, but I started to have a lot of them in college, and it was kind of funny back then. You know, it's, you remember what you did last night? Not really. What happened? You know? Wake up on the bathroom floor, wake up with, they had, what was it called? I don't remember. RAs were like the little police people of the dorms. And, actually, they were there to help people. We looked at them like police people. they were just rule enforcers, too, I guess. I'd wake up with charge slips and stuff like that. And it was just, it didn't matter. You know, it just rolled off my back. I didn't look at any of that. Or my declining grades as a consequence of my drinking at all. And I was doing well in running, but that was about the only thing. After about 2 years, drinking had started to increase. Drinking, I wasn't really sure if I wanted to do the running thing. And that was the very first time, and I've heard people talk about it coming to AA, but the very first time they felt a part of something, really a part of, is when they got sober and felt, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I ran on this team, I was a member of that team. I felt like I belonged there. It's what I wanted to do. It was all, you know, it was important to me, is what I'm trying to say. And that kind of started to go by the wayside, even though I was still doing it. I was, like, sneaking some nights in, drinking, and not going to class. And the pathetic thing about that is I had, because I don't even know if they do it this way anymore, when we signed up for class, we got to pick whatever we wanted, whenever we wanted. Before everybody else turned in their classes, because we were in athletics, we could make our own schedule. I don't know why I kept taking morning classes. Part of it was because practice was in the afternoon, but it just, you know, even on Tuesday, Thursday, I just, no way I could make it to 8 o'clock class. And so I got one of those letters that said, you know what, you need to sit out for a little while. And so running abruptly stopped. All my friends abruptly stopped. I had to pack my bags and go home. And, you know, for the next, I guess maybe not the entire 8 or 9 years, but something in that neighborhood, I would develop a pattern. And that was increase drinking, get really drunk, try to hold a job, con my parents into sending me back to school. I can remember a couple of very serious discussions with my father. And my dad was a great guy. I mean, Korean War and football coach and all this. You'd think he'd be a, you know, whip-cracking guy. He wasn't like that. But I'd go into these talks with him knowing, it's like, oh, my God, I've got to, I didn't mind asking him, but I'm going to have to put up with the lecture. And it was a long one, really long. You know, but I'd go in and I'd give my spiel and believe every word of it about why I wasn't going to be able to get anywhere in life if I didn't finish this or do that or, you know, whatever. And, you know, he'd buy it, and I'd be like, I've seen the people that aren't doing anything, and I don't want to be like that, and blah, 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 blah. And he'd send me on my way, and I would go back to the same school. I would try another school. I would try a third school, working and taking classes, and you know what? I didn't finish any of them, none of them. You know, it became more important to drink. I remember taking a class at University of Richmond. That was one of the times when I only took one class. And I would park myself in Stuffy's, which was about a mile or two away, and drink two or three pitchers of beer before I went to a religion class. You know, it was just ridiculous. That's, you know, how it started going for me. It had become obvious to me by this point that the people, I had some good friends growing up and like through high school, and it was like, it started to become obvious that there were two different things going on. Their life was going on and mine wasn't. You know, they were finishing school or they went into a trade or they got married, they bought a house, they had a family. And my mom and dad's house was like the rest area off of the interstate. You know, I would pull in and try to get my act together and then go get another apartment and live with five guys down on whatever Lee Circle down in the Fan. I'd move in with some girls on Morris. You know, wherever I could go, and it was always coming back to mom and dad's to try to get my act together. And I couldn't hold a job for maybe a handful of months. Something would irritate me, and I would just walk out. And they weren't really necessarily the kind of jobs you'd want to hold for a long time. But, you know, it was restaurant business. You can go from one restaurant to another. And I did that. You know, temporary labor, you can show up when you want to. I did that. You know, installing insulation, they'll hire anybody. I did that. You know, at least the company that I had applied to. So it became kind of obvious with, you know, there was a disparity between I'm getting kind of into my mid-20s or closing up on that, and other people's lives are happening and mine's not. And it's still not really registering that it's anything to do with drinking. I am kind of starting to feel like I'm not doing something I should be doing. Things are amiss. You know, I wasn't in the middle of impending doom by this point, or I want to blow my brains out yet. But it was obvious that something was different. And so I had to come up with another plan. And one of my plans was, you know, I got pushed into a corner mentally, and it was, I got to have a life-changing plan. Life-changing. You know, I'm going to join the military. Normally, you do that earlier. Yeah. But I was going to do it now. And I strung this recruiter lady along for the Air Force, and really nice lady, and was kind of hemming and hawing, and finally agreed to everything and went through all of the preliminary stuff until I went down to the federal building for my physical. And unfortunately, the night before, I had to go to a bachelor party. And I wasn't even drunk by my standards, but I was still drunk the next morning when I went in for my physical, and they threw me out. You know, I mean, if I could have not drank, you know, I don't know where I'd be now. I'd have gone into the Air Force at least for a while. But, you know, it was just another plan down the tubes. And I remember walking out on whatever cross street that is off of Broad down there and thinking, so what? So what? You know, it doesn't matter. It mattered a lot more than I thought it did, because my drinking would get progressively worse. I ended up really kind of unable to work. Unwilling to work was a lot of it, but I just couldn't deal. You know, all I could do was drink. I'd bounce around to friends' houses. I'd go on some hitchhiking expeditions. Finally, I got a DUI. All this time, I'd never even knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was. But I got in a DUI, set a court date. It was like 3 months in advance or something. Two or 3 months in advance. And got near the court date, and I didn't really know what to do because I hadn't told anybody, so I decided to leave town. And I did. And I went hitchhiking down in North Carolina and South Carolina, staying with some people that I, well, people that knew people that I knew, kind of thing. And I ended up coming back from that run and, you know, hadn't worked, didn't have any money. I was living off a stack of bad, I found it was like a 10 Christmases rolled into one for me as an alcoholic. I found a pad of unused checks from a bank that no longer existed, which is great because you only get charged going one way, you know. And it wasn't all electronic like it is today. But so I was living off of that, writing bad checks up in Virginia, North Carolina, and kind of all over the place. And, you know, just that wasn't flying anymore, so I came back and in an attempt to face the music, turned myself in and, you know, went and they locked me up for a little while and then let me out and had to go back to court. And long and short of it, the lawyer that I got, or I should say that my father got for me, he was quite surprised when I laid the whole deal out to him, said, you know what, if you go to an AA meeting, this is going to look really good for the judge. And I was like, all right, well, I'll go to an AA meeting. And that was in 1989, and 1989, I believe. And so I was 24 years old, 1989. My lawyer says go to an AA meeting. I don't have a license or anything else. My mom's dropping me off at my first AA meeting. It's not good for your image. You know, I can remember pulling up to the church, and I was like, let me out here. It's like, because they were congregated around the door and smoking and stuff. Just let me out here. You know, I'll get a ride home kind of thing. I mean, it was just embarrassing. And I remember going into my first AA meeting. I don't remember anything that was said, but I remember two people that were there. But I do remember everybody was really nice, and they were really welcoming. And, you know, I don't want to say I felt like they wanted to help me, but they were seemed glad I was there. So it was a good feeling being there. That was my introduction into AA. I did my little time going through the counseling and the ASAP and all this other mess that I wish somebody had told me when I went for that interview that you really shouldn't tell them the truth. And this is going to sound like I'm making it up, and I promise it's not. I went for the interview, and it was a younger girl that was actually pretty cute. And I'm like, in my sick way of thinking, I'm like, the greater the story, the more this is going to appeal to her somehow. You know? So I laid it all out as best as I could, you know. And she's like taking notes. And, you know, I ended up in super counseling and stuff, you know, all this other stuff. And I remember going to that counseling class, and I had to do sessions and then in, groups and then individuals. And I remember the very first time I can remember feeling like there might be some relief to what's wrong with me. And I hadn't harped on the fact that there's something wrong with me. It's just everything stopped. Everything about my life. Legally, monetarily, friends, family, everything. And I remember going in there and talking to her. And I don't want to label it as hope, but maybe it was. But maybe I hoped that I would find out. And, you know, so there was a little glimmer there. And she says to me, she goes, well, have you been drinking? And I was, yes, I've been drinking. And she goes, well, you're not supposed to be drinking while you're doing the classes and stuff. And I said, all right, so I won't drink. And I found a substitute for that in the form of Percocets, which allowed me to tolerate counseling a lot better. It was just something. But that thing, kind of like Bill talks about this, the glimpse and whatever it was, Winchester Cathedral, that idea of even getting any help was gone that quickly. You know, and I was just back to my same old sham and same old lies and same old, you know, water seeking its lowest level with doing whatever I could. And I go in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for the next 4 years, getting drunk in the same place, trying to get sober in the same place, and eventually getting sober in the same place. So it's like the meetings I'd go back to, it was like the same people. I mean, they were different people, but a lot of them were the same. What the hardest part of that was when I was out drinking was that I'd see these people in different places. Like in the grocery store, you know, something at the 7-Eleven or the gas station or wherever it was, you know, and I'm ducking and running down other aisles and I don't want anybody to see me and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I just didn't know really anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would have told you that I did. I knew nothing about AA. How I wound up back here was... I had been living with a friend of mine, and I got out of that situation. My dad helped me out again, and he didn't pave the way. I don't see him as, I almost don't even like using the word, but I don't look at him as like enabling me, because I got physically thrown out of the house a couple of times. There was no doubt who was in charge. Let's just put it that way. But if I looked like I meant business, he would help me. He never gave up. And so he agreed to let me back in, and I kind of got my act together, and I started doing some work for him. He was working as a sales rep, and I was kind of doing some things under him, not known to the company, but he was okay with it. And I'd gotten that going for a little while, and I got out of my parents' house into an apartment. I got a valid driver's license. I had insurance. I had time to exercise. I had a little bit of money, not much. And it started to occur to me, you know, one of the things, the ideas that I had developed, and one of these old ideas was if I wouldn't be living this way, drinking and making the mess and hurting people, if like the big five, or however many it was, elements of my life were in place. Legally driving with insurance, a job, you know, a place out of my parents' house, all this. Yeah, I never got off the ground is how I felt, really. You know, and then all of a sudden I had all this stuff, and I'm still drinking the way I was drinking. You know, I'd go out and I'd work a couple of days, and then it would be a three-day drunk. You know, or I'd go out and work 4 days and it would be a couple of day drunk. Or I'd go out and work 1 day. You know, I never knew. I'd gone to a meeting of AA on April 17th, 1993, and sat through the entire meeting, and that's my birthday, so the self-pity was flowing like a river. And I didn't say anything, and I just sat through the meeting. And I went down after the meeting and started a three-day drunk. I woke up 3 days later, and my roommate, who was a friend from high school, he's a paraplegic, and he broke his neck in a diving accident. We're very close. The guy's just an awesome person. But he's throwing a piece of his wheelchair at me, screaming, you know. It's like, if you don't do something, you're going to die. You know, and I'm like, well, I remember sitting on that couch thinking, I've been to AA, and it doesn't work. So I must need to go, like, into treatment or whatever. And then I'm thinking, I just got this job officially, like, 6 weeks earlier. Not doing it under my dad, but legitimately for the company. And I better go in, I better go see about this outpatient stuff. So I did that. The lady, long story short with that, she's like, you've got to go to AA meetings. And I thought, you know, that's why I came to you. So I didn't want to go to the AA meetings. But I went back to the AA meetings, you know, I went back to the same church that I had left that previous, on a Saturday night, that previous Wednesday or whatever. I may have my days messed up there. And I hated, you know, I was kind of used to coming back to AA meetings, saying, is anybody new? And you get up and get a white chip, and it just kind of sucked and wasn't much fun, and it was embarrassing. But I got up to get that, and this guy I knew, Randy, was standing there. Tall guy giving out the chips, and they were out of white chips. But he didn't recognize it until I got up there. You know, it's all about me, and it's very serious, you know. So there's like that, it seemed like 15 minutes, which was probably about 10 seconds, where he wasn't sure what he was going to do, and he fishes a quarter out of his pocket. That was my white chip, you know. But, you know, I went through the motions with that, and the weird thing is I stayed without a drink for a couple of months, which was longer than I had ever been. I could do maybe 30 days, maybe 2 days, maybe, you know, 3 weeks, but I'm not one of those guys that didn't drink for 9 months or 15 months or 27 months and then get drunk again. And I never did any steps, never got a sponsor, never did any of that stuff. I would have hostages after the friendlies, the meeting after the meeting in the friendlies parking lot, the ice cream place. You know, 2 hours of my relationship woes. You know, and that's absolutely true. I mean, it's just burned into my head. But I never did anything at all outside of just complaining, basically, and trying to find dates, pick up women. But I didn't drink for a couple of months, and I ran into this girl. So it was the same kind of story unfolding again. And she was going to this big book meeting. And I kind of had this down pat. When I would go get drunk again, which it probably somewhere between 14 and 20 times, I would come in and out of AA over that period of 4 years. I would throw away my meeting schedule, but always kept my big book. I don't know why. I just probably wasn't buried under everything else in my closet, maybe. But, you know, my ceremony when I would leave would the names and the numbers. Throw it in the trash. But I had this big book, and she was going to this big book meeting, and I was interested in her, so I agreed to go after some arm twisting. And, you know, around that time, I started getting itchy. And I knew well enough what it felt like to be in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing that I was going to take a drink, knowing exactly that I was going to take a drink. It never hit me by surprise. Some things did from time to time, but not leaving AA and taking a drink. I had that feeling again. I didn't tell anybody. You know, I was at this meeting, and for a couple of weeks, this girl that I was interested in, Valerie, I'm married to her now, figure. She was kind of poking me, going, I saw you listening to that guy. Why don't you go up and talk to him? And I was like, some excuse. And, but this one night, I went up and I said, I know I'm going to drink again, and I don't want to. I don't know if I've ever done the first step, second step. I don't know. You know, and that guy, sat down with me probably for a half hour, 40 minutes, and talked to me about his own experience and explained to me some things about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he became my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor today. And that started a road trip for me over and over and over. We didn't live in town. And, you know, it was an hour and, out in Buckingham, it was an hour and 10 minutes or so. And he'd be like, be out at my house and we're going to do the third step. Be out at my house and we're going to do the fifth step. Be out at my house, you know. So he took me through the steps and he started teaching me about, I don't know if he said this word, but it was committing myself to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because AA really, like my parents' house, was kind of like a rest area for me. You know, I'd pull in and wait until the smoke cleared and then just get right back out going my own way, doing my own thing. And he really put some structure in my life. Number one, he intimidated me a little bit because he knew what he was talking about. And that was obvious, and I didn't know anything. And so I was willing to listen to him, and I didn't want to go back to the way that I was living. I'm not going to go through the steps, but one kind of, I don't want to say monumental, but one large experience that I had early on was doing a fifth step with him. And, you know, I went into that having written my inventory, probably delayed it. You know, I'd been lazy and not done it nearly as quickly as I should have. Because he kept saying, well, how long do you want to wait to get better? You know, are you going to do this or are you not going to do it? And I finished it and I went out there and I had, I don't remember what, two or three things that I hadn't even written down. You know, I'd never been through this deal before. And I'm thinking, and they were all, at least two of the three were sex stuff. And I'm thinking, there's no way I'm telling this guy what this stuff is. No way. You know, I'll tell him all this other stuff. I'll tell him how I embezzled. I'll tell him how I did this. I'll tell him, you know, about the nights in jail. I'll tell him about this stuff. But I ain't doing that. And so we sat down, and those were the first things out of my mouth. And I didn't intend that to happen. You know, and what surprised me was I wasn't received with shock. You know, it wasn't like the jaw dropped open. It wasn't like, and I really warmed up to that. You know, but I didn't realize that, this, you know, that how heavy that stuff can really be in a lot of ways. You know, and he shared some experiences with me, and we got rolling. And the that's not the neatest part of it. The neatest part of it came after that when I'd done 6 and 7, and it wasn't a day or a week or an exact time period, but sometime after that, I started to feel comfortable in AA. And I really couldn't have told you that I felt uncomfortable in AA. I thought that was just the way that I was. You know, always having to shift in my seat and move around and do this and do that and critique everybody and just be a blabbermouth. You know, I couldn't be still. I couldn't be quiet. I couldn't be here. You know, I mean, physically I was here. But that was just a really big gift to me, is starting to feel a part of AA. You know, that seat's mine. This is where I belong. I'm home. However you want to look at it, that's what started happening in my life. And, you know, he started having me doing some other things, like trying to help other people. I could handle the ashtray and the, you know, that kind of thing. That stuff was easy. Putting up the chairs, you know. What, God, what do you want me to help other people? I don't know. What am I going to help them with? You know, he's like, well, you've done the steps. You know, you've got to help somebody else. If you want to keep this, you've got to help somebody else. And, you know, so I started reaching out, and I was a miserable failure in my own eyes at that time. Because every guy that I reached out to, none of them wouldn't stay around for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever. They'd be gone. You know, I remember vividly, and I'll probably never forget it. The first guy that I got up to inventory, I assumed that he wrote it. I saw part of it at a meeting. I don't know how much he really had. But I went over to the apartment to listen to his fifth step and knocked on the door. I could hear noise inside. I could hear it. But nobody would come to the door. You know, So I just left my card in the door and left. Never heard from the guy again. Never saw him again. You know, that just seemed to be my luck. But I just kept trying and put myself in front of people at meetings and people that are new and welcoming them. And you know, after a while, some people started to stick and some people started to hang around, and I started to, you know, instead of being kind of solo, there sort of started to be a group of us that kind of moved in packs, you know, and that was really neat, you know, and it could have been very easy for me to get discouraged on rating myself, about me, you know, about whether or not somebody stayed sober. You know, and I got the story about Lois and Bill, and, you know, it didn't mean anything. It was like my hands are still empty. Yeah. Until somebody stuck around, and then I could see the value of just trying. And I just kept going. I was not a relationship expert by any stretch of the imagination. I mentioned that early in sobriety, I had met who was now my wife, Valerie. And we dated a couple of times through sobriety. We've been married, it'll be almost 6 years, coming up here in April. And, you know, some of it's kind of funny, and some of it's really sick, and some of it's kind of sad. But the neat part about it is that she attracted me to AA. And what I mean by that is not so much my pursuit of her, but she was the first person who turned me on to, it wasn't come to me, I've got the answer. It was like, come over here to this meeting with what's going on. You've got to check this out. You know, the fire had already started for her there. And a lot of that, it doesn't so much continue that way, but she's helped me a lot through my sobriety by being an example. Not directing or, you know, like that. But she's helped me a lot through my sobriety. I'm very, very thankful that she's in my life. And absolutely surprised that we're married. And thrilled at the same time, you know. I mean, it's just, I don't want to say it baffles me. It's just, it's a very warm feeling, but it's a surprise. You know, it's a real surprise. It's definitely a big plus in my life. I've been through a few things, you know, and it's really interesting because right now I'm watching other people go through things I'll probably never go through. Never say never, but I'll probably never go through. Handling them the way that AA asks us to handle them. You know, with dignity, with grace, continuing to give in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I'm getting a little cloudy here, but what I'm trying to say is it's so awesome to be a part of an AA community. It's so awesome to have examples around me, like my sponsor and my wife and these people that I'm referring to and you guys up here, and I mean, it's just like they talk about in the book, you know, sprouting up, but they're already here. And I need that stuff so much that, it's just the very essence of life to me. The idea of having a primary purpose in my life, this, I'm kind of backtracking a little bit, but I had for a long time people telling me, you got to find out what you want to do. You got to find out who you want to be. You got to find out what your niche is. You got to find out this. You got to find out that. Well-meaning people, you know. And I'll be honest with you, somewhere, I don't even remember exactly where it was, and it wasn't real early in sobriety. You know, I got sponsored dragging me around to these conferences and all this stuff, and hearing about traditions and concepts and this kind of thing, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, you know, my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That means everything else is second place. You know, my worry about where does God want me to be with employment? You know, I've been employed by the same company for the last 13 years. I don't know how. I really don't. I mean, I've often wondered about that. But what took the heat off is that I can fulfill my primary responsibility by participating in AA, and the rest of the stuff, yeah, I got to show up. Yes, I've got to make an effort. But the rest of it takes care of itself. You know, and that's an absolute gift, because not so much the message of my parents, maybe just a general society message was, you know, find out where you're supposed to be. You know, and I thank God I found out I belong to you. I mean, it's just an awesome place to be. The last thing I'll say, and I apologize, I know this has been a little bit jumbled, but the last thing I'd like to say is that, you know, I mentioned these people that I have around me being examples of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I kind of wish I could say more, and I know I can't. It's somebody else's life. But I am absolutely blessed to be a part of people that are practicing Alcoholics Anonymous and seeing them go through things. You know, I almost lost my dad, major heart attack, flying in a helicopter to UVA, driving up the interstate, is he alive or dead? All, you know, stuff like that. These problems are a lot more complex. You know, and I'm watching them put one foot in front of the other and do an AA, and the problem's being taken care of. And it just comes back to the same idea. I don't have the power to solve anything. You know, I don't have the power to solve my own problems. I don't have the power to solve my alcoholism. I just have to kind of fall in line and do this, and life seems to work out. And that's what I'm getting to watch in other people's lives up close. It's just an absolute blessing. But I think I'm out of steam, and I would like to thank you all for having me tonight.